presenting themselves as already pure when they're actually having a big problem with it, because it's a way of deflecting other people's attention. So that in itself is dishonesty. So you cannot reach a state of purity by a dishonest means. And so Baba also mentioned in the last Murali that you have to be careful about this thing called robe, this arrogance. And we also want to have high status, right? And the way many people translate getting high status is everybody looks at me and applauds me and tells me I'm wonderful, marvelous, and fantastic, right? And so lust can translate itself into that particular behavior, which is pay attention on me, I'm so smart and so beautiful and so interesting and all of this business, and I know Gyan very well and I have all these virtues, and right? Even that can be a front for this neediness which takes the form of lust. So when we want to become lust-free, it's also that we want to become anger-free, because when the desire is not fulfilled, then you get angry. And that anger will take different forms of violence. For example, if somebody else is more beautiful than you, then you'll stick it to them with your stiletto, in very subtle ways that nobody can see that you're actually doing violence, because it looks very charming. But it's actually violence. Very nasty kind. Because it comes from this anger that somebody else is getting what I want. So jealousy is related to the unfulfilled desires. So then we want to be lust-free, we want to be anger-free, and arrogance, the ego, is a front or a substitute for self-respect. So if you're having a lot of ego going on, that means there's a lot of self-respect issues behind it. And to respect the self as a pure, peaceful, loving, powerful, blissful soul is purity. So, you know, it's not so easy to become innocent, pure. Basically, there's a lot of death involved. Death. Et la mort. L'amour et la mort. So, la mort. Death of ego. The other thing about us is all of us are growing old. So we're not beautiful anymore if we were. Some of us never were, so it doesn't matter, but but you're still getting, you know, sagging skin, you know, can't walk so well, can't sit on the floor and get up like a buffalo, and this kind of thing, you know. So it's more difficult to attract people with your body. So you might fix your face, but the other part, right? Or you might do it through your hair, but of course many of us are losing it, so that doesn't work. Oh, you do it through your clothes or your shoes or your glasses or whatever you can add to yourself, your fancy items that you attach to yourself as status symbols. They also function as attractive items so that people will think that you're interesting physically. If you have a fancy pen or a fancy, you know, electronic thing or a nice, very interesting mobile phone, any of these things are extensions of your appealingness, isn't it? And so these are, we may say, subtle forms of lust. So the real purity is connected with simplicity. And simplicity is not that attractive unless you're a simple person, in which case it's very attractive. So I think that this turning of our attention into the self. There are so many things that we do to distract ourselves from what we're really supposed to be doing. And I remember when I first came to Madhavan, I was given a few instructions. And one of them was, do nothing, very, very slowly. Okay. And another one was, do not interfere with anything that's going on. Even don't think about it. Don't even know it. You know? So I think that a very nice position that I practice is I'm in the center of my cycle of 84 births. And I've had 42 male and 42 female births, so I'm not any one or the other. Right? Yes, androgynous. We're all trying to become Lakshmi and Narayan, right? Not Lakshmi or Narayan. Isn't it? So I think part of purity is to have your masculinity and your femininity in balance. So that whatever are known as feminine weaknesses are not there, but feminine strengths are there. And whatever are masculine weaknesses are not there, but masculine strengths are there. So that you are not just only androgynous, but a person who is, you know, full in all of the things that's good about the masculine and the feminine. And you're balanced and you're complete. And so to achieve that, I don't think that we can be very successful if we try to destroy our vices. It's like trying to put out a fire with gasoline. So I think that it's good to have a neutral attitude towards what your various vices happen to be. I think that your bhakti, in the Western world, there's a lot of guilt-tripping associated with religion. The Judeo-Christian culture establishes morality by making everybody feel guilty. And in Gyan, if you really think about Shiv Baba, he thinks that's ridiculous. Doesn't make any sense. Because a soul has a mind and an intellect and good sanskaras and bad sanskaras, four things. And there is no cosmic knife by which you can cut yourself, the soul, in half and throw away the bad half, and there's no waste paper basket for it either. is it? The soul is indivisible. And so we have the purity, peace, power, love and bliss as our original samskaras, and then they turn into their opposite as we lose power. And so the impurity and all the other problems that we face can be reduced to a simple concept that they exist only because of the absence of power. So instead of trying to destroy them, you can't destroy a negative because it gets more negative, right? Mathematically. So I think it's very important whenever you experience any kind of feelings of guilt that you say to yourself that that is an acquired vice that you got from the religio-cultural environment, and that has nothing to do with purity or impurity or any of that stuff. It's just an externally acquired form of suffering that you internalize that comes from the religio-cultural environment. And so whenever you experience that, it's important to say to yourself that this thing doesn't belong to me, it's been sort of injected into me from the outside, and so it's good to just create some image or some method to just put it out where it belongs, because it's nothing to do with you. Because it's necessary to have a completely neutral attitude towards your vices. And actually, they are neutral. I found it very good when Baba said in the last Murli of the last season that you please stay away from good and evil, right and wrong. Because this polarization of something being right and something being wrong is very human in terms of, it's very moral in the sense of man-made ideas about right and wrong. Nothing to do with spirituality. And so a very important part of becoming free from lust is also to become free from so-called morality, which is actually morality. Morality means people have decided this is good and this is bad. You know. And what God says is nothing doing, you're just empty. And so when your car is empty, you go to the gas station and you fill it up. As simple as that. You don't feel guilty about having an empty tank. You just understand that if you don't fill up, you're going to come to a grinding halt, and that will be inconvenient. Nothing more. You know. So one must be very, very neutral about this whole thing, because part of impurity and lust is that you get irritated when you see somebody being lustful. Somebody being lustful, and you say, oh, look at them, you know, they're so bad, you know, and I'm so good, like that. And that's not much better, isn't it? And so Baba likes us to be compassionate towards people who keep a big hole in their soul so that whatever they fill up with, it just falls out again. You know? Because what's important is to plug the hole. So, these kinds of analogies that I'm referring to are also ways to come out of the holier-than-thou perspective, because that is very corrupt. And traditionally, you find that the people who are very moralistic about how good they are and how bad everybody else is, they have plenty of problems that they're dealing with, and one of the ways they attempt unsuccessfully to deal with it is to point out how horrible and bad and wicked and unclean everybody else is. Right? So whenever we experience ourselves doing that, then we need to put up a little red flag saying, "Acha, I the soul am now engaging in corrupt behavior," which is a subtle form of lust right there. You know? Because whatever somebody else is doing is actually none of my business. Is it? Or not? You know? None of my business. If you want to be impure, that's not my problem, that's your problem. Aren't you? You see, the thing is this, human life, especially now, it's very, very rare that your husband will be faithful. Very rare. And so, in India especially, one of the things that people say to the married woman is that you have to adjust to this reality. And many religions, like for example in Islam, which is 12% of India, you can have, I think it's 4 wives. So you're only bad if you have 5. But 1, 2, 3, 4 is okay, and 5 is not okay, which is just arbitrary. You know, the Nizam of Hyderabad had 500. So that, I don't know how he managed, but anyway. So the thing is, one thing is your biological urges, which are anyway more in males than in females. Just the way it is, in a general way. So one thing is biological urges. You just have to understand or position your soul in regard to your physical body, that this physical body is having these biological urges. And I, the soul, am in a discipline where the biological urges have to be neutralized. I see, because we're talking about being BKs here, you know. And so you're either successful or you're unsuccessful. It doesn't really matter, except to you. So the important thing, I think, is how do I, as a BK, as a Brahmin soul, how do I neutralize the impact of this body on either soul? And actually, we find that if you can maintain, I think you have to calculate how much yoga do you need in order to equalize the pull of matter. Because one way to look at it is, okay, you've got the pull of Baba. Sometimes he talks about being a magnet. So there's the pull of Baba, which is the pull up, the pull into non-matter, the pull into spirit. And then you have the gravitational pull of matter, which is the pull of the body, the pull of the flesh. And so you can calculate the strength of that in your way. There's no proper scientific way to do that, I suppose. But you can figure it out, that you may decide that you need say 4 hours yoga a day, no matter what. And if you can maintain that, then you can handle your biological urges, because that amount is able to neutralize it. And so if you make that calculation and you act upon that calculation, you will be ahead of the game. Or you may have a lower number of hours or a higher number of hours, but that's a kind of normal amount for most people, and which is actually quite a lot. And sometimes we think that, well, I'm doing karma yoga, so that counts. And then we do a lot of physical work, and then we find that the impact of doing physical work, karma yoga, is short term. We're able to set aside the lustful urges for a little while, but then it comes back again, because the level of neutralization power of karma yoga is less effective than the more subtle of actually, you know, deeply sitting in a state of soul consciousness. So in that case, I would say that doing work as a substitute for yoga is a form of self-deception. And one of the ways in which personal weakness translates is in some form of addiction. And so the sexual addiction is just one of them. There's substance addiction, and there's also work, you see. And so some people, they will do too much godly service, and it will actually be addictive. And so there is benefit, but then there's also loss. So in your overall calculation, the amount of benefit that's going on may be actually less than you think. And so then you would say, well, there's a self-deception going on. And in terms of service, Baba has said that service that goes into your account of accumulation is service in which you are satisfied with yourself, the people that you are serving with are satisfied with you, and the people that you are serving, they are also satisfied with you. And then there is accumulation. Now, if we are doing work as an addiction, then the people that we are serving with will be irritated. And so will the people that we are serving, because we are actually fulfilling a desire rather than serving. And so it backfires. And then the benefit is pretty small. And so then the spiritual depletion level is not much addressed. And so then any kind of temptation of the flesh that comes along, you don't have very much power to resist it. And so then you have to get into some kind of contortions, inner contortions and manipulations and all sorts of complications to keep it at bay. And then in that sense you're struggling, you see. And okay, if you want to do it that way. I think also it's very important for people to realize that, and I may be a bit harsh here, but nobody really cares whether you're good, bad, or indifferent. Because this is a very high-stakes game. And if somebody else isn't pure, doesn't matter. Less competition. Yeah. Right? So why are we bothered if somebody else is impure when the final result is that there's less competition? So that's a paradox, which indicates that if we are really bothered about somebody being impure, that means that there's something impure in us that's combustible and gets caught up in that other person's impurity in a judgmental, arrogant, or whatever attitude, you see. And so it therefore becomes an interesting test, you know, that someone around you is impure. It may be that their impurity is directed towards you. And if that is so, you don't just sit there like a sitting duck, because that's not smart. You get out of the way. Right? You may have such an arrogance, you say, I am so pure that this person will become pure, and then they don't. And then Om Shanti for you too. You see? So that's just arrogance. And so, you know, it's important to maintain your maryadas and your solitude. And when you are really aware that you're on your own, nobody cares whether you live or die. Nobody cares whether you're good, bad, or indifferent, whether you're lustful or pure, whether you're nice or nasty, successful or a failure, then public opinion has no meaning. No meaning. So then it's like you're thrown back upon your own self. And then you come again back to the question of self-respect. And you come again back to, okay, I'm a pure, peaceful, powerful, loveful, blissful soul, and I exist hanging between God and death. Death is our exam, right? And God is our world. Yes? And how we manage this state of suspension with death is also like the pull of matter. And God is also, you know, eternal life, purification. Death is also, the word corrupt is also used for mortality and also for death, you know. So we have to become free from ego, dependencies, expectation. Some people complain that nobody's appreciating me. Do you experience? Our seniors are not appreciating us. Oh, very good, wow, wow, marvelous, wonderful, you did so nicely. Right? A lot of people say we need to be appreciated. And then the seniors are going to say, well, I'm not going to appreciate you anyway. Because it means that all of the accumulation that you have is finished. You sold yourself short. Right? Because whatever it is we do, we're doing for ourselves. And so if we want somebody to appreciate it, then it means that we want the fruit. And then it means we won't get the fruit multiplied by a few zillion later on. And so people wouldn't appreciate you because they actually think it looks better for you to be richer. Right? So So we have to be able to know ourselves, that everything that I'm doing, we've been hearing in the Muralis a lot about serving the Yajna. Serve the Yajna. If you serve the Yajna, you will get a long life, you'll get a healthy body, so many things, you know. So what do you want? You want a long life, healthy body, purity, this, that. So all of the things that you do is for a reason, and it's not for appreciation, it's for your own self. And so you're doing what you do for yourself, and there are other people around, and they're doing what they're doing for themselves. And we're also a family, so we have to be loving without being needy. If you're needy, then you're not loving. If you're loving, you don't need anything. You see? So needy and greedy is the same. Needy and lustful is the same. You see? So any kind of lack that's going on inside will translate itself into some or another behavior where you want somebody to give you something. Because it's a hunger. Right? A hunger in its extreme form, its addictive form, it's a compulsion that you have absolutely no power against. And so we have another thing in our practice which is called self-restraint. And so we have a force, a willpower. So whenever there is something that, you know, this magnetic pull or gravitational pull of matter or attraction of some other human body or some nice item, or you want power, property, status, money, whatever the thing is, you know, then you have to resist that. At first you have to identify it, that oops, the power of the magnetic force, gravitational force of matter has become greater than my yoga power. And so you have to resist that. That's what willpower is for. And you have to increase your yoga. And I think part of the nature of this game is that everything around is conspiring to deceive you, to get you to be pulled by this gravitational pull. And so Baba said at the end, you'll have the five elements of matter, they will pull on you in their extreme form, and the five vices will pull on you in their extreme form, and there'll be ghosts, you know, haunting you, and there'll be, you know, everything, all at once. And you will die in that. And so you have to be free. And that's not so easy. And I think making yourself alone and just positioning yourself between God and death, between spirit and matter, like that, is a useful practice because it helps you to be able to notice the deceptions of Maya as they come. And then you have to find a way to avoid it without causing a major upheaval or disturbance. And so there's a very nice expression in Hindi, sometimes comes in the Murli, kill the snake without breaking the stick. And a snake is also a symbol of the human body and also of lust. And so you have to kill it, but not in a manner that breaks the stick. Because if you break the stick, then you haven't done a very good job. It has to be very, you know, precise and the right amount and hit in the right place. So it's very exact, and then you look good. You are good. See what I mean? So if you make a huge fuss about the thing, then it's like very gross, you know. It's not royal. You've destroyed your relationships with the viceful people, because you have to have good relationships with the good, the bad, and the ugly. Right? Because we have to be in harmony. And we also have to be not disturbed by disturbances, or not poisoned by poisonous snakes or spiders or any of these things. We have to live with them. They're all around. But you don't have to be afraid of them. And you have to, you know the enemy. You asked about knowing the enemy. And I think the key thing is to maintain a really neutral relationship between yourself and your weaknesses. And that will enable you to be more true, more honest, less corrupt. The effort to have a neutral position, well, I think you have to face it. Face it. And I think also you have to become like water, you know, the power of accommodation. Or accommodated. And just, okay, it is there, but I'm not under its influence. If you are hating it, you know, against it, you feel bad about it, whatever, you're giving it power. You're neutral about it, you're not giving it power, and you get on with your tapasya, because all of this is for no other reason that you're simply spiritually depleted. And you have to take a lot of power, not just 5 minutes power. And so Baba has spoken about, you know, being in soul consciousness and purity and everything for a long period of time. And so how long is long? 70 years? I see. So, okay, you've had 15 years meditating. But in that 15 years, if you take any single day, the quantity and quality of your meditation, and also factor in the extent and quantity and quality of your waste thoughts, negative thoughts and all that, and then calculate how much you've done. Little bit. I remember I did this. I had been in Gyan 25 years. And I was trying to calculate, okay, let's see how much we have moved forward here in 25 years. Because on that basis I could figure out how long I need to become karmateet. So I eventually came up with the figure of half an inch. I said, that's small. We have to do something about this. So I changed my spiritual practice radically, having made that calculation. I said, at this rate, I'm going to need a couple of kalpas just to make it to the beginning. And that's not satisfactory. So you have to do it very differently. So, well, you know, just change everything. Everything. Came here. Yeah. Because, you know, I was seeing, you know, okay, you're doing Amrit Vela religiously and accurately every day for 25 years, no miss. You're doing the Murli every day, 2-3 times a day, no miss. Offering Bhog every day, no miss. Doing service 18 hours a day, no miss. That's about the maximum I could do, you know. And I said, still only half an inch. So we have to really radically change. And so the radical change had to do with deep inner work, you know, because those are all external things. So, you know, to have 24 hours a day with no waste thought, and to refine the conscience so that you know, and you know, you have to do a lot of complications and risks of one sort or another, and figure out what it is to be absolutely authentic. And then you have to go through hell, that's normal. Because without that you can't get to heaven. Right? So you have to go through physical problems, everybody hates you, and somebody wants to, you know, pull you down, and everybody wants to pull you down. You go through that, and this, and that, and the whole nine yards, you know. And you make yourself alone. And independent of position, property, number of students, number of centers, all these things, because they sort of lull you into a comfort zone where your level of spiritual advancement is rather slow. You know, you just you've got your people coming and you do programs and all of these things, and you're moving along at 2 miles an hour, and you have to reach a very high destination. So it's all to do with accelerating the state of your tapasya, your authenticity, all sorts of things. And I also experienced that, having made that calculation, I started to get a lot of sort of touchings from Baba about the kinds of changes that needed to be made. And I think that's everyone has to do their thing individually. But it's a lot to do with not being false and being absolutely real. Not being false. So that's the way. You have to be real, but if you're going to be real, you're going to get killed. So you have to be okay about that. Is it all right? Because Maya doesn't like that. And the other people don't like that. When you make yourself really true, people don't like truth. And if you get true, they're going to get rid of you. And you have to not mind about that. It's okay. You're eternal and immortal. Can't be got rid of. But you get pushed to the next level. And I had a very interesting experience once of just breaking through a glass ceiling that wasn't there, you know. And just finding myself in a whole different planet of sense of self. Very nice, you know, but you had to work for it to get there. And I also made an image for myself of a pyramid with floors, you know. And on the bottom floor it was lots of people. And as you go up, there's less and less people. And at the top, they say, no, lonely at the top. So unless you can handle solitude, complete solitude, total rejection and isolation, you can't sit on the top. You see? So it's not lonely at the top, it's alone at the top. And then when you're alone, your world is Baba, and all the rest is 3D wallpaper. Three D wallpaper, right? Because you're in the middle of your drama, and there's this cycle of 84 births with all the scenes and sceneries and people. 3D wallpaper. Moving. So you're watching the drama, you're in the drama, but you're quite neutral about it. So I think of it as, you can't get upset by 3D wallpaper. So these are just different ways that you look at it, just different perspectives that you adopted in order to be free and comfortable with yourself. Anybody have any other questions or comments? Or, well, I think that guilt comes in the form of a kind of burning feeling inside. And it's very, very disempowering. It makes you feel bad about yourself. And it comes as a wave. It can even come as a wave of sorrow, that particular form of sorrow, guilt sorrow, or kind of guilt mixed with sorrow, maybe mixed with sadness and loneliness and a variety of negative emotions all mixed together as a wave. And it comes and it overwhelms you and takes you with it. And so I think what you have to do is detect that this thing is a paper tiger and not buy into it, so that every time it comes you are better at being neutral about it. And you maybe, if you're a good surfer, you don't mind about big waves. And you ride them and you enjoy. So there's a transforming aspect of it. I think that we experience the wave and it grabs your heart, you see. So you have to have a lot of courage, a very stout heart, to bear this thing. I think we have to understand the process by which external moral authorities traditionally and conventionally instill things into young people. And one way that it's expressed is in military training. I had one brother, Howard, you know, from LA, so he was an actor. He does a drama about the Vietnam War. It's a kind of brainwashing, yes. But you know, it's like your trainer says, you're worms. What are you? Worms, you know. Right, you got it right, you're worms, you know. And in Christianity, you've got original sin, you know, which came 400 years after Christ, you know, why St. Augustine invented that. We're going to have to not talk there. You see, they don't tell them, oh, you know, 400 years after Christ, we came up with the idea of original sin, and you better start really feeling it, you know, because you're a sinner. And the only way you can get out of it is by pleasing me. Right? This is the manipulation that is taught to children. And if you resist it, you're going to get beaten to a pulp. Or, if not physically beaten, demeaned and humiliated verbally for one reason or another, you see. And then eventually it goes in, you see. And then very easy to guilt trip. And so what you have to do in Gyan is take it, all that junk out. You see? And so the wave of guilt has something to lock onto, which is the internalized bad feeling that's, you know, it takes you. And well, you have to undo it. And you have many opportunities, because it takes many times, you know, you get hit by all these tsunamis again and again in one way or another. And it happens a lot in Gyan, because you get your seniors will do the job of the parents, teachers, and religious leaders in a non-jnani environment. And so you continue to get the practice, whether you're in gyan or out, it doesn't really make much difference. But you have to practice to disengage and to not be there for that thing, you see. Because if you've got good floating capability, if you're light and easy, then the wave is not going to bother you particularly. You become so strong in heart, you know, your heart is very not sick, you know, it's very healthy, very open. It just goes right through, doesn't do anything, you know. And that comes from this conviction that I don't care what you guys say, I'm a pure, peaceful, powerful, loveful, blissful soul, and the rest of you is just 3D wallpaper. And you have to use these different approaches to disengage yourself. And then the power of the guilt trip eventually has no power over you. And you got to claim your power. Because it comes because you've given away your power through this brainwashing tactics and whatnot and so forth. And this is why I find it very good, you know. Here you are, you're an eternal soul, and you're going to heaven anyway. You've already been through hell. So anybody who tells you you're going to hell, they need their head examined, because they don't know anything. And anybody who tells you you're this or that or the other, okay, that's their privilege, they can do what they want, that's their part in drama, nothing to do with me, thank you very much, you know. So in that way you separate yourself from accepting more and more of that stuff. And you assert the reality of who you are to yourself. Because it really doesn't make any difference whether they like you or not, or whether they want to hurt you or not. Because they're all blind, you know. They don't see you. But you should see yourself. You see what I mean? And I find also a very powerful thing. You give people full permission to be as disgraceful as they want. Doesn't matter. You know? Because the key thing is, you have to be free. And at any cost. That's the game. Very high stakes. Kill the snake. Don't break the stick, because you have to live with these guys. Of course she does. She's supposed to. She's going to hit you until you get the point. Well, I saw her today giving gigantic tsunamis of love to one sister who a few years ago was, oh, Daddy Yungi, you know. Because she's tough. She's very tough, and she's not going to allow you. And the only way that she can get you to give up that is by hitting you to the point where you say, hey, enough already. And get your power and get your self-respect. And that's the old-fashioned way, but she's an old lady, you know, in that sense. And so she does it in that way. But you need to understand the game, you know. And so it's a very conventional way of doing it. And she's got a lot of sort of traditional, conventional ways of doing things, because she learned from Brahma Baba, who was also a conventional, traditional person. You know, you have to put the thing in its social context. And you cannot imagine that spiritual people are going to be like fluff. They're not spiritual. If they're like fluff, they're not spiritual. You know. Dadi Gulzar is tough. You just haven't seen it. I've seen it. I have been amazed at how tough Dadi Gulzar is, and I thought, ah, this is interesting, you know, and I found that it's really good to know that if you're going to be anything in this game, you have to be very tough. And I experienced that in myself for about 6 months. I experienced being extremely strong. And even one day Daddy Jenki said to me, "You are very strong." I said, "Yeah, I am." End of conversation. And you have to find your power. And if you haven't found your power, you can't be soft. And if you're doing fluff, you know, fluff doesn't have any substance. But if you're really strong, like Shiv Baba, he is strong, he is tough, and very occasionally the power of Baba bleeds through Avyat Bhagdada's expression of himself through Dadi Gulzar. And I've seen on 5-6 occasions the force, the toughness of that spirit. See, you're not playing with any fluff here. And when he says, "Okay, I'm not going to be the loving father anymore, I'm going to be the teacher," you know, but he's still being very loving. But one fine day, you will see that. And if you're not up for it, it'll be too much. So I think also it's very important to get away from the idea that spirituality means to be fluffy. You know? Purity is like a burning, you know? Because if you want to test gold, you test gold with, you know, one of the ways is hydrochloric acid. Right? You pour hydrochloric acid on gold, nothing will happen. You pour it on your hand, plenty will happen. Because it's searing acid, you see. And so, if there's any impurity in us, any kind of impurity in us, when that hydrochloric acid comes, you're going to be in trouble. Because you can't handle it. But if you are totally pure, 24 karat gold or perfect diamond, you don't care about that stuff. And so all of this, you know, strong waves of stuff that comes from this corner or that corner of the drama, whether it's from a great yogi or a great sinner, it doesn't make much difference because you still have to manage it. Oh, well, the hydrochloric acid doesn't have any effect. Because you have to be tested all the time. You know, somebody will find out what your price is. Everybody has a price, right? So if you have a price, you're not pure. Well, take any 24-hour period and just see what you are like in that 24-hour period. I think it's a good gauge. It's like a microcosm of the macrocosm. And so if you're able to really notice what bends you off track, what upsets you, what elates you, what anything that moves you off your pinpoint of stability, and how long it takes you to get right or get free away from any of these influences, I think that you'll be able to calculate how you're doing. Because if you can maintain it for, you know, a good long period of the day, then you're in the long time ballpark. Because you can have somebody who's been in Gyan for 70 years and they haven't moved a centimeter. And you can have somebody else who understood and very quickly moves very fast. So it's not really a time thing, but in a 24-hour period, how attentive are you? How conscious of yourself are you? Yeah. Well, interesting. I've heard a few people talking about it in the last few days. The question is the relationship between lust and sleepiness in yoga. Sleepiness in yoga is sometimes been described as a karmic account. You know, there's some sort of karmic account that's stopping you from being awake. Could be lack of fresh air, definitely. A lot of times it is lack of fresh air. And so then you have to factor that, you know. But you can tell when you're suffering from lack of oxygen or when there's a kind of heavy vibration that just makes you go to sleep as soon as the murli starts, and then when it finishes you're up again. And the fresh air thing hasn't changed. So there's something going on. And I think it's to do with impurity. I feel that we're able to listen to the murli if Baba allows us to. And that if we are not right with him, then we won't be able to listen to it. And either we'll be having a lot of waste thoughts, so then we wouldn't hear a word of it, or we fall asleep, or something. Yeah. And then if you're really good with Baba, then he's going to open up your intellect, and you're going to enjoy it a lot. I think that the murli is many different things. It's a bath, you know, also. So you sit in your bath and you get clean without any particular... You just enjoy being in the bath. And then the murli is also a dance. There's music, so there's this thing going on. And then sometimes you want to be really studying, you know. And so you want to... And I think different people relate to the murli differently. A lot of people relate to it as like a 2x table. 2x2 is 4. 6x8 is whatever that is, you know. And somebody, the teacher will teach you the murli like your so-and-so times tables, and people give answers, but it's not very deep that way, but a lot of people do it that way. And then you get somebody like Daddy Janki, who is very engaged with the murli and really studies it, so she draws your attention. So, I mean, some people present you the murli as a samosa, which they cut up into little pieces and give you just a plate full of bits of pastry and peas. And then some people give you the samosa with chutney on top. And you enjoy it. Different. And that, so you have to kind of factor out the differentiation of the reader of the murli and their particular things that they want to add or subtract. But it's a conduit between the soul and God, which enables your yoga to persist, and which also lets you know how your yoga is. So how you relate to the murli on different days is also a gauge about where you're at. And so how you feel while being in the murli is partly to do with certain external factors, so that you just cancel out those, but then find the inner factor, which is a real thing that's telling you something about yourself, and that will be useful, you know, because this BK is highly subjective, and so your third eye, your conscience, all of these things has to be working very well in order for you to pick up the indicators that come from the Murli to help you to figure out where you're at and help you to move forward. You know, there are some messages that you get from external people that are positive and some that are irrelevant and some that are negative, and you have to figure out which is which and use the ones that are useful and disregard the ones that are nothing to do with anything. But if you get it wrong, then your progress is slowed down. Well, you see, fear is when you're going to have fear anyway. Fear is like a given, but either you have courage or you are a coward. So whether or not there's fear, I think, is not the issue. Fear is given. But does it make you behave with cowardice or does it make you behave with courage? So fear is a useful stress. And if we observe ourselves comfortably with courage in the face of fear, then you can say, okay, I'm going nicely. Doesn't matter about fear. But what matters is if you go into cowardice, then it's not good. So you have fear of being alone, fear of being rejected, fear of failure, fear of success, fear of not understanding, fear of being left out, fear of being left behind, fear of being in the wrong group, you know. So many things. You know, I won't have any money. I might die. My mother will die. My father will die. My didis and daddies will die. Or they might chuck me out. Okay, it doesn't matter. Whatever, let it come. And they say the coward dies 1,000 times before the actual death, and the courageous person takes the actual death at that time. So, you know, it's really helping you to understand to what extent you have faith. I think there was a point in today's Murli that the people who were stuck with Baba, they stuck with Baba whether there was any food or not, because they have faith that if you're in with God, you're not going to die of starvation. You may die of other things, but not of that. And so don't worry, you know, have courage, have faith. It's good to be a person who is not bound by fear. It's a very great bondage, which doesn't allow you to do anything. And in this game, if you have courage, it stands you in very good stead for a long time. And what was it? We were having a retreat about this thing in South Africa in April, and we happened to be having our retreat right by the world's highest bungee jumping place. So three of the sisters bungee jumped after the retreat and got rid of tons of fear. So that was good. Acha, let's have a song. Om Shanti.